Houston, Texas. To me, this is an unfamiliar city with unfamiliar faces, though on the surface it looks just like my hometown, which is a bit southwest from where I am now. My guest and I have just finished our respective bowls of ramen, much to the dismay of her two cats, who we did not share with, and are thus well prepared for today's riveting discussion. I'm here with Priya Fink, who is a music performance major at DePaul University. Hello and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. Welcome, Priya. I'm glad to be joining you in Houston. So we are starting with initial thoughts on the book. So why did you choose this novel, other than the fact that you know it pretty well?
Yeah, I chose this novel because I ended my junior year analyzing this with my class, and I thought it was really interesting because when I read it, you know, I thought one thing, and then talking about it with my teacher in my class just brought out so many new ideas that I thought were really interesting. So I thought it'd be fun to share this.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, well, do you have any initial thoughts for our readers?
Sure.
Maybe people who haven't read this book before.
Yeah, okay. So, The Great Gatsby, I really did enjoy reading it. You know, some books, like, I don't know, it kind of takes you a while and it's slow at points, which, you know, of course this book had some of that, but, like, it was a pretty, like, fast read for me because there was a lot of very interesting symbols throughout the book that I thought Fitzgerald was very, like, careful in placing and how he used them throughout the book and when he brought them back. And it was just kind of cool to see how he played around with that.
Absolutely. Well, in terms of how I feel about this book, this is not my favorite Fitzgerald book, which is probably, like, not something great to say. Well, in introducing this to readers who haven't really read it. It is a good introduction into this era, though, because of those symbolic elements and because I feel like Fitzgerald is so careful in the way that he phrases things and so careful with his prose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a really great way to get into this genre and movement. This is the Lost Generation, right?
Yeah, so. Absolutely.
So in terms of the beginning section, what does the beginning mean and why was it structured that way? Can we compare it to any other part of the novel, such as the end? I wanted to talk a bit about the history of this book. Do you know anything about the history?
Probably not as much as I should.
It's okay. I learned this in English class as well, so this is not something I just know. But so this book, it wasn't very popular at first, but they made so many copies. They made millions of copies, expecting it to be a major sellout, just like his first few books. And Fitzgerald actually died before this book was popular. He wrote it as the pinnacle of his career, but he died thinking that it was the worst book he had ever written. So it didn't become popular actually until after World War II, and why it became popular after World War II is they had mass-produced all these copies, and so they sent them to the soldiers. And when the soldiers came back, they were like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
Yeah,
so it's just a kind of a weird, interesting bit of history on it, kind of a morbid bit of history if you consider that the nature of Fitzgerald's death, which we might get into later. Yeah, but the beginning section.
So, yeah, the beginning section, first impressions when I was reading it, well, you learn a lot about Nick just from this little bit. He says that, yeah, my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some advice that I've been turning over my mind ever since. When you feel like criticizing anyone, he told me, just remember that all the people in this world haven't had the advantages that you've had. So right there, we see that he's been pretty privileged, right? So kind of gives us a little bit of insight in his upbringing. And we also, if you keep reading, I won't read all of it, but we learn that he's kind of a detached observer,
right?
And he's a little judgmental, which I don't think it's a bad thing though. So just something about Nick that I wanted to point out. He's really used as a plot device, and but it's interesting because most of the time a character like Nick would stay constant,
like the omniscient narrator in Crime and Punishment.
Yeah.
Like, that's a very constant force, whereas Nick is constantly changing.
Yeah, exactly. He changes as a person, which is really interesting, because most authors would use someone like Nick. They'd keep them constant so that, we can rely on them, you know, like if they have one opinion of something, but then they change, it's confusing.
It's ethos, yeah.
But yeah, Nick is different, but I really don't think it's confusing. I think it was kind of smart how Fitzgerald did that. It's different from what you usually see.
Mm-hmm. So, it introduces his bias really well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a quote at the end, and it's where he meets Tom after the whole ordeal with Gatsby.
Mm-hmm.
Not to give away any spoilers, because this book, I think a big part of it is that there's a huge spoiler at the end, but no one tells you about it. They just tell you it's a great book, and it's like literary masterpiece. So he meets Tom, which is one of the main characters,
mm-hmm.
and his cousin's husband, who he knew at Yale. And he says, you know what I think of you, or something
mm-hmm.
along those lines. Like, you know that I thought that you guys were all just a rotten bunch anyway. And this just introduces that kind of judgment. There's a quote in here that says, reserving judgments is a matter of infinite hope. So here he's basically saying, I'm going to be very judgmental. It's totally
mm-hmm.
fine, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Oh, Nick.
Okay.
And then can we compare this to any part of the novel, such as the end? Do you think it gets a bit more dense at the end?
Yes, I do. I mean, the end, there's a lot to the end. I think the beginning is more about, like, giving us some insight as to, like, who Nick is, because the whole story is told from his perspective, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then the end is more about, like, I don't know, he talks about, obviously gets into the American dream and how, like, after Gatsby he felt that it was not attainable anymore. And so it gets pretty dark in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
But also he says, Gatsby believed in the green light, the orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. To tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther, and one fine morning. And then as a line, my teacher said, there's a lot of people have, you know, tried to finish that line. And she thinks that, or, you know, we discussed it and saying that it should be, in one fine morning we will grasp it, like, kind of that's what he was going for. So
yeah,
it's pretty dark in the end, but then this tiny little, like, those few sentences is just like, yes, Gatsby believed in the American dream and he pursued it honestly, and now that he was gone it seemed like it was over, but Nick is saying that tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms, like Western expansion,
yeah.
And like, it, you know, it's in the past, but, like, there's still hope, you know?
Yeah, in this ending section, what I like about it is the ending, two chapters, chapters 8 and 9, this is a really quick book. The ending section brings up, the ending two pages brings up every symbol and theme that he explored throughout the novel and kind of wraps it up and saying, okay, finally, this is what I think. And it's a lot more up to the reader and up to the audience throughout the whole book, whereas in the ending, it's more definitive. It's like,
mm-hmm.
it's not written more definitively, so it's not like, I think this. It's more like, oh yes, and there's this green light and this current. But
mm-hmm.
you definitely get a shallower view into what Fitzgerald himself thinks, as opposed to what he's thinking through Nick.
Yeah, it's kind of, just reading back at this now, it's kind of interesting because, you know, he was just saying, like, we will run faster and, you know, we will grasp it. But then the last line, we beat on, boast against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. It's kind of like the constant pursuit of the American dream is, like, holding us back from moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, it's kind of confusing in that sense.
And the same thing where, like, Gatsby's house is empty in the beginning of the novel when he moves there, and it's empty
mm-hmm.
at the end of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
As
yeah.
well, so it's saying, like, we start and end at the same place.
Yeah.
And there's this weird, like, quote or, like, wives' tale that says every man or every individual dies alone.
Mm.
So there's this concept called the hedonic treadmill, otherwise known as hedonic adaptation, and it was done in a study by a group of researchers from Northwestern University and the University of Massachusetts in 1978. It basically says that people who win the lottery and people who became quadriplegics are in the same state of happiness after 5 years. So even though being a quadriplegic obviously would make you very depressive and winning the lottery wouldn't make you incredibly happy, that happiness evens out over the course of several years. And so this is why most humans, you know, notwithstanding people with mental disabilities or illnesses, when they're in a rut, they get out of that rut very quickly. And if they are overly happy, they get back into the norm very quickly. And people's norms vary, but there is a norm for every individual. And so this is the same thing. I think that Fitzgerald's trying to communicate at the end that we may start and end at the same place, but there are definitely valleys and hills in between. Okay, question two?
Yeah.
Is there a character that fits the mold of a Fitzgerald cameo in the novel? Could it be Nick, Tom, or Gatsby?
I mean, I think it's Gatsby.
Okay, why do you think it's Gatsby?
Well, Fitzgerald was really interesting. He was very organized and very obsessed with becoming a better person, you know, but he had all these schedules, and he would like schedule like all of his day, and at the beginning of his day he'd ask himself like, oh, how can I be a better person today, like what can I do to be better, you know. He was like obsessed with that self-improvement, and you kind of see a little bit of that in Gatsby.
Oh, the schedule.
Yeah,
you know, the schedule at the end that his father brings up to Nick. And it's like, 6 a.m., get up, do weight exercise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's the same. And I think that's like a pretty clear connection that Fitzgerald was making in the book. Yeah, so one thing that we learned from Gatsby is we can be whatever we work hard enough to become. Mm-hmm. And I think Fitzgerald kind of lived with similar goals as Gatsby.
There, I guess something to contradict my own question here would be that maybe a Fitzgerald cameo doesn't exist in this book, but he always writes Zelda into his books. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very obvious in this case which character is Zelda. Mm-hmm. Can you guess?
Daisy,
yeah. And just the way that he describes his voice in the quote section, I have definitely one or a few quotes on just how velvety and how, I don't know, almost like delicious, how tasty her voice is. And that's no coincidence. The book is once again to Zelda, right? So yeah. He definitely pays more attention to Zelda than to himself, but I think as a consequence, he accidentally wrote himself into Gatsby.
Yeah.
And Gatsby lived pretty much as disastrous a life as Fitzgerald ended up living.
Mm-hmm.
Though he destroyed himself in different ways, like for example, sure, perhaps Gatsby is the ideal version of Fitzgerald or something, because Gatsby doesn't drink. Fitzgerald was an alcoholic.
Yeah. Speaking of Daisy, she's fragile and beautiful, but she's kind of useless. She's
not as strong a character as Zelda would be.
Right, absolutely. And I feel like, okay, so she feels trapped with Tom because he gives her financial protection, right? And so she can keep all of her stuff.
And social protection.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, going off of that, she loved Gatsby, but she was a victim of her society because she couldn't leave Tom because it would ruin her rep, you know? And so it kind of gave her this really big conflict, internal conflict.
Well, and she also has self-awareness of that conflict, because there's that scene when she's talking to Nick on the porch and she talks about her baby girl being born, and she's like, when I found out that it was a girl, I cried, because, you know, the best thing to be in this world is a stupid girl, but if you have any semblance of intelligence or self-awareness, it's a terrible life to live.
Yeah.
And she's like, I didn't want that for my child.
Yeah.
So clearly there's something going on there in terms of internal conflict.
Right. Absolutely.
Question three. What are the major themes of this novel, and are they consistent with other works by Fitzgerald?
Definitely. Materialism and money is a big one.
Mm.
So in the book, Fitzgerald talks about new money and old money, and also the decline of the American dream during the 20s.
Or the American dream period.
Yeah.
Because there's both. Mm-hmm. There's evidence for both of those.
Right. But, I mean, we honestly mostly see that at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So this book is from The Lost Generation. Mm-hmm. And The Lost Generation was all about this idea, all wars fought, all faith in man shaken. And this book is just like a complete reflection of that.
Yeah. Do you think it's the premier book of that generation? The one that represents it the most?
I think so. From the ones I've read, I think this one represents it.
Yeah. So The Lost Generation, for people who don't know, is a group of 1920s writers. They all moved to France. They felt that the American dream was disingenuous. They were disenchanted with it. And they all had kind of these ragers. they were known very much for that lifestyle of partying and spending a lot of money. Artists in this group include Gertrude Stein, Ernest Hemingway, Ezra Pound, Picasso, Dolly,
Fitzgerald,
of course. and Fitzgerald's wife, Zelda, was also at the very center of this movement, just mm-hmm. because she was such a great symbol for them. Yeah. Almost like a mascot, but I don't want to demean her that way at all. Okay, major themes I got. Actually, cruelty, I think, is a really big theme.
Mm,
and that's something that people wouldn't think of, especially since it's the Great Gatsby and there's feathers and lights everywhere. So many notions of cruelty, and it almost reminds me of Wuthering Heights in that regard. Education and status, we kind of already touched this, but just another way to frame it. And then love, both requited and unrequited. And I think that's just a product of Fitzgerald being Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
Okay, now we can talk about some of these themes. Do you want to talk about old money versus new money?
Sure. So, we see Gatsby is the perfect example of new money. He lives in the West Egg. His money is earned. He's a self-made man. He's less sophisticated than the people in that we see in the East Egg for the most part. But, you know, he's earned his money. In contrast to the people in the East Egg, where their money is inherited and they're more arrogant and snobbish.
Well, yeah, historically, so West Egg is new money. So these are all people who have struck it rich, but they've struck it rich in their own lifetimes. Whereas mm-hmm. people in East Egg, they represent the old money. And those are people whose families would have migrated from Europe and have taken their money and their estates with them. And I think Nick talks about this a bit when he goes back to Chicago at the end of the book. And he talks about the Caraway clan and his estate and all of that. And so we get kind of little touches of the old money that he comes from there. Do you want to talk about cruelty? Above all, the characters in this book are cruel to themselves before they're cruel to other people. And
all of them?
No, not all of them. I mean, Tom certainly is not cruel to himself. He's a bit of an inflated ego, I think.
Mm-hmm. But
yeah, but just the way that they carry on their affairs, their respective affairs. So this is not much of a spoiler, but alert. Tom has an affair with Myrtle Willison, who's the wife of an auto mechanic, and she's this very, like, full, boisterous, vital woman. Daisy has an affair with Gatsby, which is her love from her childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Gatsby, in particular, has a bit of self-loathing. He has to rely on materialistic significances in order to feel good about himself. So he'll often turn to Nick and say something like, "My house just looks really great in this light, doesn't it?" Or, "It looks really great right now, doesn't it?" Or, "The pool looks really wonderful." And he doesn't really have any genuine source of self-love.
In terms of themes, we have another episode on The Great Gatsby coming up in about 2 months or so. So I don't want to harp on the themes too much to get too repetitive. So we're going to move on to question 4, which is, what is Fitzgerald's comment on the American dream, and how is that relevant for readers today?
The way he closes it, Gatsby was pretty representative of the American dream, and now that he's gone, it seems unattainable. However, they do leave us with this kind of hope for humanity, maybe not exactly pertaining to the American dream, but I don't see how it wouldn't kind of be connected to that a little bit. He's saying that it's completely unattainable, but it doesn't really leave us on the most optimistic note for attaining the American dream.
Yeah, I mean, I agree definitely that the last few lines aren't optimistic. And this certainly wasn't an optimistic point in Fitzgerald's life. I mean, he was accruing a lot of debt from the lavish lifestyle that him and Zelda were leading. But I also don't think that it completely discounts the idea of the American dream. It's saying it's inevitable that you will fail if you are chasing infinity. But if you're chasing a very specific aspect of the American dream, then you can definitely attain it. Like, Gatsby, for all intents and purposes, did achieve the American dream. And so did Fitzgerald, if we're still talking about Gatsby and Fitzgerald.
or Gatsby as Fitzgerald's cameo. I guess I can speak to this because I'm a first-generation American, and reading this book, perhaps I had a different take on everything from other people who are maybe second and third or even later generations of Americans. And both of my parents achieved the American dream. So I personally can't see past the fact that I think it still exists and it's still attainable.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, and so as far as Fitzgerald's comments, I don't think he was so shallow-minded that he would discount something that the nation is, for all intents and purposes, like, built on. Well, do you have any last comments about the book?
No, I think we're good.
Cool. So now on to related resources, because not all of them are books. There's a book called Z by Teresa Ann Fuller. It reminds me a bit of this book called H, which is about Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights. It's a fictional account. It's kind of historical fiction, but it follows Zelda Fitzgerald and her journey before and after she married. There's also an Amazon Prime show of the same name. It's a really wonderful Amazon Prime show, actually, surprisingly. And the actress who plays Zelda is Wednesday Addams from the Addams Family.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Another movie is Midnight in Paris by Woody Allen. It's on Netflix. It's a great little film about the lost generation. It also has Tom Hiddleston, who's one of my favorite actors. There's another book called A Movable Feast by Hemingway. There's an unfinished chapter at the end of the book about Fitzgerald, and it's interesting how he has so little to say about Fitzgerald throughout the whole thing. It's kind of like a gossip column about the lost generation and Gertrude Stein, Ezra Pound, and all of them, and the bookstore Shakespeare and Company, which he had an enormous tab at when he lived in Paris. He has plenty to say about Zelda, on the other hand, and he takes as many chances as he can get to deface her in the novel, which is kind of weird, and it occurs throughout the novel in these one-liners. There's another book called This Side of Paradise, and it's F. Scott's first book, and that's the one that made the biggest splash while he was still alive. It's my favorite book by him. And then there's also Downton Abbey, the show and the New York exhibition, which I was really fortunate to go to when I was in New York a few months ago. That's in the same time period, much of the same fashion, much of the same morals and principles. So it's just interesting to compare American life versus European life. Okay, Priya.
So I did a lot of comparison with this book to Huck Finn, because I read them at a similar time. And one really interesting thing that I found was there's a similar issue in both book with the reliability in the narrators. So in Huck Finn, not much of an issue, but just because Huck is a child, so he's naive, which means that everything that he sees on his journey, we see from his eyes, which means two things. One, that it makes more of an impact on readers because seeing it from Huck's eyes, it's so surprising to him because he's never seen anything like this before. So, like, the emotions that he has toward it, we really feel. The second thing is that also he's a child. You have to kind of analyze it more for yourself because
in order to figure out what he's saying.
Yeah, because which is kind of interesting because it kind of leaves some interpretation open to you while still giving you Huck's view.
It's almost like The Sound of the Fury in Benji, the Benji section.
Right, yeah. We have a similar situation with Nick.
Yeah.
And that there's kind of this, like, conflicting viewpoints because what he sees is one side of it and kind of have to leave it open to, like, be able to figure out what he's saying in terms of where he comes from.
Right.
But where he comes from is kind of, like, to our advantage because we can sympathize with it. It'd be different if he came from, like, old money, which not
right.
Most people do, but, like, him coming from the new money side kind of makes it more reliable for us because
mm-hmm.
we can relate to that.
That's something that we don't have to figure out. He tells us where he comes from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Another segment, favorite quotes. So I have a couple. I won't overindulge myself with them. First, the city scene from the Queensboro Bridge is always a city scene for the first time and its first wild promise of all the mystery and beauty in the world. Another, even Gatsby can happen without any particular wonder. Third, his count of enchanted objects had diminished by one, talking about Daisy and the green light. She saw something awful in the very simplicity she failed to understand. Again, Daisy. Oh, this is one of my favorites.
And so with the sunshine and the great bursts of leaves growing on the trees, just as things grow in fast movies, I had that familiar conviction that life was beginning over again with the summer. That's in the beginning. And last but not least, I think that voice held him most, with its fluctuating, feverish warmth, because it couldn't be overdreamed. That voice was a deathless song. It's talking about Daisy's voice and the allure of it.
Yeah, so I have a few. The first, I was within and without, simultaneously enchanted and repelled by the inexhaustible variety of life. Another is, angry and half in love with her and tremendously sorry, I turned away. One last one. Sounds kind of ironic. And I like large parties. They're so intimate. At small parties, there isn't any privacy.
I love that one. All right, thank you, Priya, so much for being on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
It was an awesome time. If you enjoy the discussion and would like to hear more from me, consider checking out the last episode where I discuss literature's most beautiful passages. Everything DH and I can be found at didianandhawthorne.blueberry.net, except blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Also, stay tuned for the next episode in 2 weeks' time. We'll be discussing the Dewey Decimal System in another solo digression episode. Still there? One more thing, then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. See you next time. I wanted to mention a new project on DH&I that I'm super excited about. So only those of you who are staying to the very, very end of the podcast are going to know about it first. Starting in October, I'm going to be releasing weekly Friday episodes in addition to our normal scheduled episodes as part of a project that I am calling Horrifying Classics. Ta-ta for now!